This is Audible.
Dreamscape presents Stone's Rules, How to Win at Politics, Business, and Style by Roger Stone. Narrated by Paul Costanzo. To Nydia Bertrand Stone, my life's partner, who has suffered my enthusiasms, shared my victories, and given solace in my defeats. It is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles, or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs, and comes short again and again, because there is not effort without error and shortcoming, but who does actually strive to do the deeds, who knows the great enthusiasms, the devotions, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who at the best knows in the end the triumphs of high achievement, and who at worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who know neither victory or defeat. Theodore Roosevelt. Introduction by Tucker Carlson. People often accuse the media of having an agenda, and in some ways they're right. Most journalists are conventional liberals, and the coverage often reflects that. But outright manipulation of content, I've rarely seen it. In fact, in more than two decades of working in the news and opinion business, I can think of only a single time I've been censored outright. It was the day a network executive forbade me to interview the author of this book. "Just so you know," he said, "the problem isn't that Roger Stone is conservative. We have conservatives on all the time." "Okay," I said, "then what is the problem?" "Well," the executive conceded, "Stone does know everything about politics, and he is famous, and articulate, and entertaining. But you still can't have him on." "Huh?" It was obvious I was never going to get a straight answer, mostly because there wasn't one. The executive obviously liked and respected Roger. He told me so in hushed tones. But for reasons he couldn't quite articulate, he worried that booking him would somehow bring trouble to the network. Like many in the upper reaches of media, business, and government, this executive stood in fear and trembling before the legend of Roger Stone. And for good reason. Roger Stone is a troublemaker. Indeed, not just a troublemaker, but perhaps the premier troublemaker of our time, the Michael Jordan of electoral mischief. This is either terrifying or delightful, depending on your uptightness level. I love it. Television executives don't. That's the difference. But Roger Stone is more than just the most colorful political operative in America. A man who for 30 years has blurred the line between high-level consulting and performance art. He is also wise, as you'll learn in the following pages. From his early years with Richard Nixon to his work subverting democracy during the 2000 Florida recount, Roger has been paying keen attention to the human drama and drawing lessons from it. Psychology, business, power, partisanship, food, fashion. He has deep insights into all of it, and equally deep convictions. Cufflinks should be small, betrayals should be avenged, and political debts should be paid. And under no circumstances should your pocket square ever match your necktie, on pain of death. That's Roger's advice, or the beginning of it. If you've been to the self-help section of your local bookstore lately, you know there are almost as many guides to life as there are people looking for guidance in life. Yet crack the cover of any of them, and you'll recognize the same recurring themes. Stop struggling. Accept yourself. Be who you are. Robert Fulghum, Rick Warren, and Deepak Chopra may come from three distinct religious traditions, but all wind up at the same destination, floating peacefully in the soothing waters of Lake Mead. Not Roger. His counsel is earthier, more outwardly focused, and probably more honest. Here, for example, is Roger on forgiveness, I will often wait years to take my revenge, hiding in the tall grass, my stiletto at the ready, waiting patiently until you think I have forgotten or forgiven a past slight. And then, when you least expect it, I will spring from the underbrush and plunge a dagger up under your ribcage. It turns out that everything you needed to know was not covered in kindergarten. I could go on, from memory, but you've got rules to listen to. Roger and I disagree on pleated trousers, but other than that, he's on the level. Enjoy. Tucker Carlson. Preface. For 30 years, I have been on the front line of American presidential politics, serving 8 National Republican presidential candidates. I have engineered the elections of senators and governors. In the business world, I have assisted multi-billion-dollar mergers and acquisitions. I have solved complex public relations and political problems for corporations, pro-Western foreign governments, trade associations, and wealthy individuals. Over my many years as a consummate political animal, I spent untold hours talking politics and learning political tactics from Richard Nixon, whose presence on 6 presidential ballots nationwide is surpassed only by Franklin Roosevelt, served as a traveling aide for the great American patriot Senator Bob Dole, driving him while he was in Washington, D.C., cutting up his meat, and occasionally helping him with a collar button. Dole's courage and persistence allowed him to overcome the grave battlefield injuries he suffered when hit by a German shell in Italy. Regularly briefed and prepped Ronald Reagan while organizing his presidential campaigns in 1976, 1980, and 1984. Targeted ethnic Catholic Democrats for the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980 and 1984. Was sent on a mission in 1988 by James Baker that allowed George H.W. Bush to beat Mike Dukakis in California by 1 point. My efforts resulted in toppling corrupt New York Governor Eliot Spitzer, who was using the services of multiple call girl rings while prosecuting others for prostitution. Spitzer funded his early political career with an illegal loan from his billionaire father, and then perjured himself in a civil suit filed by his disgruntled Democratic primary competitors. I helped undermine the Reform Party after they cost Republicans the White House in 1988. I shut down the 2000 Florida presidential recount in Miami-Dade County by fomenting a riot, and I launched the idea of Donald J. Trump for president. My nearly 4 decades in the political arena have made me an extraordinary cast of enemies. I've been attacked by David Byrne of Talking Heads, Rosie O'Donnell, washed-up clown Tom Arnold, fantasy novelist J.K. Rowling, unemployable lunatic Keith Olbermann, a bevy of elitist twits at the Daily Beast, knife-in-the-back propagandists at HuffPo, and a chorus of other fake news sites like Raw Story and Salon and Slate and the dipshits at Mother Jones, which endlessly spew assorted and sundry bullshit about yours truly. I've been able to make Ari Melber, the hapless dope at MSNBC, sputter, and the brainless talking heads at CNN like Jake Tapper and Anna Navarro rage. I love it. As I said in the culmination of the Netflix documentary Get Me Roger Stone, I revel in their hatred, because if I was not effective, they would not hate me. My favorite quote from the Joker, the villain in the Batman comics, is, "Introduce a little anarchy, upset the established order, and everything becomes chaos. I'm an agent of chaos. Oh, and you know the thing about chaos? It's fair." I will admit I love ruffling the feathers of the Democrat GOP ruling duopoly, and the elites of both parties, who have worked in tandem to drive America into a ditch. The Bushes and Clintons and Obamas have seamlessly colluded to promulgate and perpetuate policies that have uniformly made America weaker and have bankrupted us, while they and their crony corporatist friends have enriched themselves by exploiting the system they have corrupted in such cynical fashion over decades. In 2012, I even had to bolt from my longtime political home, the party of Lincoln and Goldwater, in revulsion over its nomination of Mitt Romney, whose father, Michigan Governor George Romney, stabbed Barry Goldwater in the back in 1964. Mitt Romney is not a conservative, and only became a Republican after deciding to run for governor of Massachusetts. In 1980, Mitt supported Massachusetts liberal Paul Tsongas over Ronald Reagan. I had great sentimental attachment to the Republican Party, having served as young Republican national chairman from 1977 to 1979, and having worked for the campaigns of four Republican presidential nominees. During that brief stint, in which I left the GOP over the Romney nomination debacle, I proudly supported the presidential ticket of Governor Gary Johnson and his running mate, Judge Jim Gray. Johnson was a successful New Mexico governor who cut taxes and regulations and spending while advocating the legalization of marijuana and same-sex marriage. With Donald Trump's hostile takeover of the Republican Party in 2016, I returned to the GOP, comfortable again battling the country club Republicans. My decades of provocative, unconventional, often wild forays into American politics have also garnered me some outlandish monikers in the media. The Weekly Standard anointed me the High Priest of Political Mischief. L.A. Weekly, clearly aiming for neutral journalistic objectivity, described me as a slash-and-burn Republican black-bag election tamperer. The New York Times credited me with a long history of bare-knuckle politics. The Atlantic called me skilled in the dark arts of politics. Politics1.com crowned me the Jedi Master of the Negative Campaign. The once dominant, now doddering ex-anchor from NBC News, Tom Brokaw, accused me of bringing some kind of a James Bond evil factor in all of this. Whether you think these are compliments or condemnation depends on your political point of view. One man's devil is another man's savior. One man's dirty trick is another man's civic participation. One man's dirty trickster is another man's freedom fighter. To me, it all comes down to winning. It comes down to using any and every legal means available to achieve victory for my friends and allies, and to inflict crushing, ignominious defeat on my opponents, and yes, enemies. Politics ain't beanbag. It is not for the faint of heart, nor is it a place where the risk-averse will ever find shelter. What sets me apart from the cookie-cutter crowd of conventional political consultants, strategists, and hired guns is that I never pretend otherwise. Political games are for others to play. I wage political warfare. Some have called me a strategic genius and a master dirty trickster. I've been blamed for stealing the 2000 election for George W. Bush in Florida. I've been accused of destroying the National Reform Party after eccentric billionaire H. Ross Perot cost the GOP the White House in 1992 and 1996. I've been credited with propping up the candidacy of Reverend Al Sharpton to divide the Democrats in 2004. It has even been suggested that I was behind the forging of Texas Air National Guard documents purportedly lifted from George W. Bush's service record that, on the eve of the 2004 general election, were fed to Dan Rather at CBS, ultimately destroying, by his own hand, Rather's career as one of America's top three network news anchors. Those who claim I elected Trump are wrong. Trump elected Trump. He's persistent, driven to succeed, clever, stubborn, and deeply patriotic. I am, however, among a handful who saw his potential for national leadership and the presidency. The others were two former presidents. Both Reagan in the White House and in Nixon in his post-presidency make note of it. As a lifelong witness, participant, and practicing patriot in our American political tradition, I have made my bones, and then some. I have acquired many valuable lessons, beginning from my first days as an ambitious 19-year-old upstart in the Nixon White House, to my daily mission today, waging pitched battle, almost around the clock, on every conceivable front, with every available resource, against a determined, well-funded, incredibly underhanded juggernaut of the dirtiest of dirty tricksters, who are intent on subverting everything great about this country. To those who accuse me of puffery and airbrushing myself into history, I will only plead guilty to being a showman. If you cannot not be interesting, you cannot get anyone's attention. Back channel, intermediary, confirming source, all the same thing. Dramatization is not exaggeration. These lessons, garnered from nearly a half century of intense political engagement, have translated into a collection of operating rules, useful to anyone with ambition in life. This book is a collection of the best of all I have learned through decades at the top of American politics and business. But Stone's Rules is not a political primer. It is a compendium of rules for war, politics, food, fashion, and life itself. It also includes my thoughts on advertising, public relations, and media. Among other things, you will learn how much linen to show at the end of your suit cuff, a proper recipe for Sunday gravy, the name real Italian-Americans give to red sauce, how to design a billboard, how to select cufflinks, how to budget a political campaign, what to wear, and what not to wear, ever. Think of Stone's Rules as the style manual for a master of the universe, the instruction book for someone who wants to move like a pro. My many colleagues in the political world have been hearing me spout these maxims for decades. Now, I share them with you. Roger J. Stone, Jr., New York City, April 20th, 2018. Stone's Rules, Part Number 1, Entering the Arena. Stone's Rule Number 1, There are men of action and men of words. The original phrase, there are men of action and men of thought, gives value to thinkers and philosophers, apart from men of deeds. Thinking is great, and it is critical to conceiving and planning action. But ultimately, it is action that determines the course and direction of civilization. Leaders who are frozen in contemplation and indecision, those unwilling to take political risks, will ultimately lose. As Theodore Roosevelt said, the credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, not to those who stand on the sidelines and point out the failures and shortcomings of the man in the arena. There is no political reward without risk. There is no shame in losing. There is only shame in failing to strive, in never trying at all. Stone's Rule Number 2. You can't win if you don't get in the game. More precisely, you can't win if you don't run. I have seen veteran congressmen with a solid political base wait around for the right race for governor or senator, ending up spending decades in the lower house. Matt Rinaldo was a veteran congressman from New Jersey. A moderate Republican, he was popular with Democrats and enjoyed union support. Potentially a strong statewide candidate, Rinaldo looked at every U.S. Senate and gubernatorial race with interest, but never ran. Rinaldo was a good man who did many good things for people in the House of Representatives. He was a good politician who worked hard for his district. The polyester-clad man of the people could have done great things as governor or in the U.S. Senate. I often think about Rinaldo's potential, lost to the ages, because he waited and waited for the right moment, for that favorable race that never came. Politics is about taking risks. You can't win if you don't run. Stone's Rule Number 3. Don't hide your scars. They make you who you are. But don't fight the last war either. Life is a battle. The lot of a political consultant is both seasonal and cyclical. I've experienced periods of great prosperity and periods of being dead broke. No two campaigns are alike, and the great mistake of many in my trade is the tendency to fight the last war. Democratic pros who ran Hillary Clinton's 2016 campaign simply assumed that black voters would support and turn out for Hillary Clinton in comparable numbers to what Barack Obama had garnered. Their fatal miscalculation here is a classic example of fighting the last war. widespread awareness about Danny Williams, Bill Clinton's African-American son, who Bill had abandoned and Hillary had banished, was a trend among internet-savvy African-Americans that the Clinton campaign never spotted. No less than 38 million people saw conservative filmmaker Joe Gilbert's documentary, Banished, the untold story of Bill Clinton's black son. And at least 22 million people saw the catchy rap video by the Freenauts, which told the Danny Williams story on multiple platforms, including the hip-hop media titan Worldstar. Donald Trump would eventually succeed in besting the vote totals of either Mitt Romney or John McCain in black precincts of Detroit, Milwaukee, Philadelphia, Charlotte, Richmond, Cleveland, and Miami-Fort Lauderdale. In every one of these cities, Hillary ran anywhere from 3 to 7 points behind Barack Obama's high water mark. In other words, African-American voters elected Donald Trump. As the years following November 2016 more than demonstrated, Hillary Clinton is perpetually mired in a dysfunctional obsession with fighting the last war, which saw her defeated in the most humiliating and well-deserved fashion imaginable. Hillary clearly fails to recognize that she is not only fighting the last war, as in the previous war, but that this war was also her last war, the ignominious finale to her dubious, ultimately failed political career. Stone's Rule Number 4. Past is fucking prologue. I'm constantly surprised by young reporters and political consultants who have no sense of history and precedent. To understand the future, you must study the past. When I was among a select group trying to get Congressman Jack Kemp on the ticket with Ronald Reagan in 1980, I tipped the late Niles Latham of the New York Post that powerful New York State Party Chairman Dick Rosenbaum, Nelson Rockefeller's ballbuster, had told Reagan that Kemp was okay for VP. Rosenbaum gave him the signal, I said. "Wow, that's big," said Latham. "Who's Rosenbaum?" Having instant, constant access to information is not the same as having knowledge or context for it. Trite as it may be, it is no less true, to paraphrase George Santayana, that those who ignore history are doomed to repeat it. Stone's Rule Number 5. Make your luck. Frank Sinatra, the chairman of the board, said it best. "People often remark that I'm pretty lucky. Luck is only important insofar as getting the chance to sell yourself at the right moment. After that, you've got to have talent and know how to use it." Donald Trump is another success story, whose life seems to have been blessed with luck. But Trump is a firm believer and practitioner of the rule that you must make your luck. In his case, through deft positioning and relentless drive. Stone's Rule Number 6. Reach higher. Abraham Lincoln lost races for the Illinois legislature, House, and 2 bids for the Senate before he eventually won the White House. In 1957, New Jersey Congressman Harrison Pete Williams lost his House seat. 2 years later, Williams ran for the Senate and won, serving in the Senate from 1959 to 1982. He would have served as long as he liked had he not been caught up in the Abscam scandal. Bush paterfamilias Prescott Bush lost a Senate race in Connecticut after being tied to Planned Parenthood in an effective bid by his opponent to deny Catholic votes to Bush. 2 years later, Bush won a special election to fill a vacant Senate seat. Prior to his bids for Senate, Bush had never served in a position higher than moderator of the Greenwich Town Meeting. My friend, the late Senator from Pennsylvania, Arlen Specter, lost races for district attorney, governor, and senator before finally snagging a Senate seat in 1980. Arlen never gave up. New York's Alphonse D'Amato, a crude but effective Pole, was the Hempstead town supervisor before he toppled the inestimable Jacob Javits in 1980, seizing the Senate seat Javits had held since 1957. Al had levied charges of poor health and infirmity against Javits, a political mugging. In 2016, Donald Trump became the most improbable winner of the presidency, perhaps in modern times. Against seemingly insurmountable odds, he outthought, outfoxed, outworked, outmessaged, and outcampaigned the sluggish, entitled political animal, Hillary Rodham Clinton. Dream big. Reach big. Try the impossible. Because sometimes it works. Stone's Rule Number 7. Miracles do happen. This story was told to me by the comedian John Biner, who heard it from an old black musician who toured with jazz great Louis Armstrong. I confirmed the anecdote with Charles McWhorter, who served as a traveling aide to then-Vice President Richard Nixon. In the late 1950s, the State Department made Louis Armstrong an international goodwill ambassador and underwrote a series of concert tours through Europe and Asia. On return from the first two tours, Satchmo and his entourage were waved through customs without having their bags and belongings searched, thanks to his ambassadorial status. In 1958, after his third tour, Armstrong landed at New York's Idlewild Airport, except this time he was directed to the usual customs line for a thorough search. Customs agents had gotten a specific tip about contraband being smuggled into the country and were searching everyone entering the U.S., no exceptions. Armstrong joined the long line of travelers waiting their turn for customs agents to scrutinize their possessions. The problem was that among the world-famous trumpeter's possessions were 3 pounds of marijuana, right in his suitcase. Apparently, some of the goodwill returned to him in kind, the real kind. Armstrong began sweating profusely, realizing he was about to get busted for trafficking narcotics into the country while traveling on behalf of the government. Aside from the penalties a black man would likely face for such an offense in America of 1958, jazz legend or not, Satchmo realized the shame it would bring to the country given his ambassadorial status, official or not. It's probably a safe bet, Louis began praying mightily. Within minutes, a set of doors swung open, and into the customs area swept none other than the Vice President of the United States, Richard M. Nixon, buffered by his small security detail, and followed by a gaggle of reporters and photographers. Nixon spotted Satchmo, who also had drawn a small gaggle of people around him, waiting in the line, and, ever the shrewd politician, saw an opportunity to get a wire photo with the beloved entertainer. The Vice President diverted his entourage over to the jazz man and asked, "Satchmo, what are you doing here?" "Well, Pops," Armstrong called everyone Pops, "I just came back from my goodwill tour of Asia, and they told me I had to stand in this line for customs." After some chit-chat, long enough for a photo to get snapped, Nixon, no stranger to physical labor, grabbed both of Satchmo's suitcases and said, "Ambassadors don't have to go through customs, and the Vice President of the United States will carry your bags to the exit. Do you have a car waiting?" Whereupon Richard Milhouse Nixon, who just a decade later became the 37th President of the United States, muled 3 pounds of high-grade pot through customs without ever knowing a thing about it. Miracles do happen. Stone's Rule Number 8. If life is a performance, be a costume. The key to being a great dresser is to think carefully about it, but make it look effortless and natural. Sprezzatura, as the Italians call it. Think through what you will wear for your most important meetings, and particularly on TV. Stick with basics and classics. No plaid sports jackets on TV, unless you want to look like Rodney Dangerfield in Caddyshack. A solid navy blue tie with a crisp white shirt. French blue shirt, or blue and white striped shirt, is a sure winner when matched with a navy, charcoal gray, or pinstripe suit in blue or gray, single or double-breasted. No blends. 100% wool or cotton. Natural fibers only. I once went to a New Jersey State Republican convention in the 1970s where there was so much double knit, it was a fire hazard. Think through your leisure wear and eschew lycra and synthetic fibers. Track suits are for pimps. Polo shirts, khakis, well-cut jeans, pleated cotton shorts, and non-baggy t-shirts are tolerable, depending on climate. Dress like a preppy, even if you aren't one. Develop good dressing habits early. Plain and simple as the dress is, it is a sure test of a gentlemanly appearance. The man who dresses for dinner every night of his life looks easy and natural in it, whereas the man who takes to it later in life generally succeeds in looking like a waiter. Stone's Rule Number 9. Dress with sprezzatura. A gentleman must show a graceful, easy carelessness. Never reveal calculation or effort. The appearance of exertion detracts from your look of nonchalance. Fred Astaire used to throw a new suit or hat against the wall several times to get the newness out of it. Clothing must move with you, creating an air of comfort and casualness. A look that is studied or carefully coordinated will look like a contrivance, detracting from your allure. Think Gianni Agnelli, Cary Grant, Douglas Fairbanks Jr., William Powell, Ronald Coleman, Jack Buchanan, and Jack Kennedy. They all had sprezzatura. Jude Law, Jay-Z, Calvin Klein, and Lapa Welkin have it today. Even Fran Lebowitz, who has men's suits custom made for her by Anderson & Shepard, has it. You can have it too. Stone's Rule Number 10. Dress British, think Yiddish. I first heard this from Reagan's Secretary of Labor, Ray Donovan, who was referring to his lawyers during the corruption investigation that forced him from the cabinet. English tailoring, with its soft shoulders and natural drape, emphasizes the power and shape of the upper body. Much of Savile Row tailoring comes from the military tradition that includes a full chest and tapered waist. Italian tailoring is softer and slouchier, ideal for nightclubs and card games, but wrong for business meetings and legal conferences. Thinking Yiddish is meant here as a compliment, meaning wise, canny, wily, and successfully. Stone's Rule Number 11. To win, you must do everything. Lyndon Johnson was a crude and vicious political competitor who viewed every contest he ran for public office as having the potential to end his life. Johnson ran aggressive campaigns and never put his eggs in one basket. When Johnson told a young aide, "To win, you must do everything," the young man said, "Yes, sir." "No," said Senator Johnson. "I mean everything." Indeed, Johnson meant everything, including murder. John F. Kennedy was the only thing that stood between LBJ and the top job in the land, for which he had lusted his entire life. It is no small coincidence that when President Kennedy, on the eve of launching his 1964 re-election campaign, agreed to take a late fall political trip in 1963 to Johnson's home turf of Texas, at the behest of LBJ's closest political friend and crony, Governor John Connally, Kennedy returned in a body bag, and Johnson returned as president. Stone's Rule Number 12. Think big, be big. These have been the watchwords of President Donald J. Trump since long before he was elected. Trump made billions, lost them in the real estate crash, and got them all back, and won an unwinnable campaign against an unbeatable opponent. Through it all, he never lost his optimism, his determination, or his confidence. Stone's Rule Number 13. Never quit. I've seen it all, from Watergate to the triumph of Reagan, the HUD scandal, the 2000 recount, the Bush crime family, the collapse of the neocons, the Clintons' war on women, the improbable rise of Donald Trump, and the continuing efforts by the deep state to destabilize and delegitimize his presidency. Life is a battle, and no matter how difficult the situation or how overwhelming the odds, one must never quit. Winston Churchill, a man whose name is nearly synonymous with the word indefatigable, could not have said this more clearly than when he rallied the United Kingdom to persevere against the Nazis, to the bitter end if necessary, saying, "Never, never, never give up." So too did Richard Nixon recognize this imperative. Nixon said, "A man is not finished when he is defeated. is only finished when he quits. If I don't get at least 5 death threats a week, I figure I must be doing something wrong. Every minute of every day, there are online troll bots doing the nasty bidding of malicious clowns like David Brock, who spend millions creating a constant avalanche of fake news designed to foment hate towards my family and myself. I laugh. Complicated, convoluted, often totally incomprehensible lies about me are concocted and then amplified to no end by a smug Greek chorus of corporate and leftist media hyenas, holed up at the usual direct-peddling fake news outlets like the Washington Post, Salon, Daily Beast, Politico, Huffington Post, Vice, Slate, and too many other leftist propaganda factories to mention here. It makes me smile. As the Nietzschean meditation that became G. Gordon Liddy's mantra instructs us, that which does not kill me makes me stronger. Legendary football coach Vince Lombardi said it best, though. Quitters never win, and winners never quit. Life is cyclical, particularly in the political arena. You will know great victories and ignominious defeats. You will experience great thrills and great disappointments. Today's defeat can plant the seeds of tomorrow's victory. It is far better to strive and fail than not to try at all, I'd say, from my 40-year experience in the political arena. When times are darkest, I remember the perseverance of Franklin Roosevelt in his fight against polio, Winston Churchill in his wilderness years, and, of course, Richard M. Nixon's comeback from multiple political defeats. Stone's Rule Number 14. Never be scared of anyone or anything. Frank Sinatra said, "The big lesson in life, baby, is never be scared of anyone or anything." Frank didn't get to be chairman of the board by avoiding risks and being afraid to fail. No politician or political operative ever did either. Like Frank, I do it my way. You should too. Let nothing stand in your way. Be the man or woman in the arena. Stone's Rules, Part Number 2. First Impressions. Stone's Rule Number 15. If you are engaged in any business or profession, you are much more likely to succeed if you are well-dressed than if you are badly dressed. An impression is made based on how you are dressed. It's how you present yourself, how the world sees you. No one will hire you if you are slovenly with unpolished shoes, unpressed suits with baggy knees, unkempt hair, gaudy jewelry, and less than perfect hygiene. Dress for success. Stone's Rule Number 16. The only thing worse in politics than being wrong is being boring. Politics is entertainment. Only an ivory tower policy wonk or a radical leftist militant, the insufferable Marxist type comes to mind, is simultaneously arrogant and delusional enough to think that people, 1, have time or patience for fruitless complications and complexity in their politics, or their lives for that matter. 2, will suffer tedious technocrats longer than they would a commercial break on TV. 3, give a shit about politicians or community organizers' tedious plans for the universe, or, generally, for complicated schemes being peddled by political schemers. When you bore the voters by saying nothing new, and by taking no public risks with bold ideas or proposals that shake up the status quo, the bored voters tend to look elsewhere for ideas and candidates they do find interesting. A front-runner cannot sit on a lead and serve up mush. Politics requires motion. The only thing worse than being wrong is being boring, Nixon told me. When it comes to your image and your style, being bland is analogous to being boring. Just like being a bore, if you present a bland image, if you lack a personal style, it is not that people remember you as bland or boring. It is that they don't remember you at all. Stone's Rule Number 17. Look good. Feel great. Politics is like theater, An actor has confidence when he knows he is perfectly costumed, made up and lit for the boards or film. Knowing that your hat has just the right tilt, your collar lays perfectly, your tie is jauntily knotted, your suit emphasizes your upper body development, either through visits to the gym or excellent tailoring. You have a tan, good haircut, extremely limited jewelry, and the knowledge that you cut a fine jib will make you feel great. Only when you feel great can you crush those who oppose you on the battlefield. Napoleon, who had some pretty cool clothes, made his worst decisions when plagued with hemorrhoids, although riding on horseback for hundreds of miles leading an army probably added to his problem. If you don't look great, you can't feel great. If you don't feel great, you can't make good decisions. If you don't feel great, you can't be great. Solid sartorial advice. An old English guide to fashion I once read said, "Never spend a shilling when sixpence will suffice. Never purchase anything not absolutely needful. Waste nothing. And economize on clothes by taking due care of them." Stone's rule number 18. White shirt plus tan face equals confidence. When John F. Kennedy arrived in Chicago for the first presidential debate in 1960, he spent the afternoon not with briefing books and closeted with aides, but on the roof of his Chicago hotel with two buxom young ladies sunbathing. When Kennedy entered the NBC studio for the debate, journalist Theodore H. White wrote, "He looked like a bronzed god." Nixon got to Chicago late, looking tired, haggard, and underweight from recent knee surgery, and famously refused makeup. He also wore a light-colored three-buttoned sack suit. JFK looked tan and confident. Nixon looked pale and rattled. "Before an important meeting or speech, I will always get some rays, and wear a white suit to accentuate the contrast, and create the aura of good health and athleticism. No matter the climate, if the sun is shining, you can get a little color from a half hour in the sun. A sunburn, however, will show that you're trying too hard." Stone's rule number 19. Great leaders have personal style. There is one thing that sets a leader apart from the rest, a personal style. FDR's naval cape with the frog closures, MacArthur's aviator frames, an oversized corncob pipe, Churchill's polka-dot bow ties, an impresario Panama hat, Eisenhower's waist-length military jacket, Anthony Eaton's mustache, Lincoln's stovepipe hat, Patton's ivory-handled pistols. "Only a pimp in a whorehouse would have pearl handles," said Patton. A leader of men wants to establish differentness. Franklin Roosevelt wore pince-nez glasses long after they were fashionable. Herbert Hoover fished in a coat and tie and still made fly casting look effortless. Reagan was never without his pocket handkerchief, folded square and perpendicular to the line of the top of the pocket, 1950s style, and used pomade to hold his thick hair in place long after it was in common use, giving it a wet look. Roosevelt used a cigarette holder, as did Tom Dewey. JFK's hair was tousled just so. Are these affectations or idiosyncrasies? I think they are just natural style. Above all, they avoid the sameness of the masses, a world where most dress alike, eat alike, and live alike. They help create for the leader a mystique that is key to leadership. A real leader always maintains some mystery. Being well-dressed doesn't take time. It is a mistake to suppose that it is a waste of time to dress well. A well-dressed man need not spend any more time in dressing than a badly dressed man does. Stone's rule number 20. Use a cigar. Vaudevillians knew that using a cigar while doing stand-up gave a comedian time to think on his feet, while taking an excessively long time to light the cigar, or an exaggerated puff. While it doesn't work for elected officials, I have used a cigar for intense television interviews, such as my appearance on New York City's cable news network, New York One, after allegations that I had made a threatening phone call to New York Governor Eliot Spitzer's 82-year-old father regarding illegal campaign loans he had made financing his son's political career. Nothing beats a large, slow-burning stogie to give you time to consider each question and formulate your response. Stone's Rule Number 21. Great leaders are detached. Great leaders always pose themselves as detached from the political process. Charles de Gaulle, Ronald Reagan, and Franklin Roosevelt were always big-picture guys who let minions handle the gritty details of campaigning or governing. Trump is a big-picture guy in this way. Donald Trump's campaign was a big-picture vision of America's return to greatness, along similar lines to Reagan's 1980 campaign. Once the pillars of his campaign were articulated and communicated to voters, details were of very little importance. Jimmy Carter's micromanagement of the government, down to such minutiae as scheduling use of the White House tennis courts, made him incompetent as a chief executive. Reagan probably didn't know that the White House even had tennis courts, nor did he care. Yet Reagan was a highly successful chief executive. Carter bungled the Iranian hostage rescue attempt, while Reagan went on to win the Cold War. Detachment should not be read as isolation. Nixon isolated himself behind his aides once he became president, limiting his political field for the country and ultimately contributing to his downfall. No congressman, senator, or even cabinet member could get in to see President Nixon, except in the most formal and predetermined of circumstances. George H.W. Bush was so isolated from anyone who wasn't a multimillionaire or influential Beltway so-and-so that he had never even laid eyes on the newly ubiquitous barcode scanners being used in all supermarkets and grocery stores across the country. Worse, Bush was actually dumb enough to say so. At the same time, Bush would often absentmindedly read his stage directions out loud, as he did in 1992 when campaigning in New Hampshire, saying, "Message, I care." Barack Obama started down the same path when, after sweeping the middle-scheduled 2008 Democratic primaries, he responded to charges that he was long on oratory and light on specifics by saying, "Now, this is a different speech, with a lot more details, and a lot fewer applause lines." Great leaders are detached, but not disconnected. Stone's Rule Number 22. Build a foundation for your wardrobe. The foundation of every young gentleman's wardrobe should be a well-cut navy suit, a solid medium gray or charcoal suit, either a navy or gray-striped suit, muted, chalk, or beaded stripes, a navy blue blazer, and two or three button models, a pair of gray flannel trousers, two generously cut pairs of khaki trousers, and a Harris tweed sports jacket in dark brown or gray. For the slightly older gentleman, the basics can be augmented with an additional striped suit in either blue or gray, and a double-breasted blazer, which could be navy blue or bottle green, but must have military-style gold buttons. Rotate your suits, sports jackets, and blazers. Be sure never to wear the same garment 2 days in a row. Buy high-quality wooden hangers and keep your clothes in good order. Hang suits, jackets, and trousers in a well-ventilated area. Never hang a jacket or trousers on a peg or a hook. Cheap underwear is even a greater mistake with men than with women. Your undergarments are the foundation of your wardrobe. Whether you like tidy-whities or boxer shorts, buy quality. I myself prefer a tastefully striped cotton boxer short from Charvet. Calvin Klein and Two Exist make high-quality banana hammocks if you are so inclined, but I like my junk to breathe. Stone's Rule Number 23. The blazer is the foundation of a gentleman's wardrobe. The navy blue blazer is the most fundamental component of a gentleman's wardrobe. It can be dressed up with a necktie and gray flannel trousers, dressed down in an open-necked Brooks Brothers cotton button-down shirt and wide-cut khakis, or dressed down further with a French-cut T-shirt and well-fitting jeans, indispensable for travel. The blazer should have two or three buttons of the gold military style, or flat metallic buttons like Porfirio Ariza Rubirosa, the legendary playboy, race car driver, and Dominican diplomat, and always worn with a simple knit tie. No bolo ties east of the Mississippi. Western wear is fine in the West. Unless you're trying to look like Elvis Costello or Chris Isaak, bolo ties should not be worn east of the Mississippi River. I can appreciate the Western wear made by the rodeo tailor Nudie for every country star from Tex Ritter to Elvis Presley, but those are costumes. Western shirts, belts, and cowboy hats are fine for real wranglers. But when you wear them in Washington or New York City, you look like a hick. Stone's Rule Number 24. The Suit. The two-piece man suit, originally called a lounge suit or a business suit, is still the standard for white-collar class gentlemen. Believe it or not, some suits sold today are not sewn together, but rather fused, which essentially means they're glued together. The high temperatures used in dry cleaning causes this glue to melt, which is why sometimes you see bubbling from the facing of the glued components of your jacket. Fused garments should be avoided altogether, and a gentleman must insist on a suit that is, at worst, machine sewn, and for a few dollars more includes some hand stitching for the lapels and collar. The well-cut suit is your armor. This is what marks you as a master of the universe. Somber shades of blue and gray connote understated good taste. Above all, make sure your suit fits. Throughout these rules, you may find certain annotations about men's tailoring. So, good God, man, make sure your clothes fit. Different silhouettes and styles of tailoring more closely fits certain body types. The closely cut high armhole Italian style is good for the tall, lean man, but not complimentary for his more portly brother. The soft-shouldered Ivy League two-button American cut works best for stocky men. The tall man should avoid vertical stripes, while the fat man should avoid them in horizontal. Choose the style of tailoring that is best for your build. Avoid dry cleaning. I'm sure the American Association of Dry Cleaners would hate me, but the harsh chemicals used in dry cleaning will break down the fabrics and the finest garments over time. Fibers that are dyed navy blue, black, or dark gray are already stressed by holding the dye. Dry cleaning dries the fabric out, which is why suits cleaned in this manner begin to shine. Unless you happen to sweat profusely, suits can be cleaned by dipping a whisk broom in cool water and gently brushing the suit. Put outside in fresh air, but not direct sunlight to dry. It is essential that a suit or jacket and trousers be allowed to wear out immediately after a wearing. Unless you are a slob, you should only need to clean a suit twice a year if worn in regular rotation. Stone's Rule Number 25. A black square-bottomed knitted silk tie is a necessity. You could roll it up in your pocket. It doesn't wrinkle. You can use it for an emergency meeting in which a tie is de rigueur and still look good. It goes with everything. In a pinch, you could use it as a belt. In an emergency, you can use it to tie a broken suitcase closed. No resourceful gentleman should be without one. It is truly indispensable. Stone's Rule Number 26. Build a foundation for your wardrobe. Look at Nixon's tie knot in the 1960 debate. It has no discernible shape. Now look at Kennedy's. Tiny, elegant, and jaunty. Whether you prefer the enormous knots favored by the Italians, but pioneered by Edward VIII, the Duke of Windsor, who wanted his tie knots thick as pudding, or you prefer the four-in hand with perfect dimple, a tie knot must sit in the collar properly. Congressman Jack Kemp, Reverend Adam Clayton Powell Jr., George Patton, George Raft, and Calvin Coolidge all used a neat collar pin to make the tie knot sit at the right angle. It's a look that will never go out of style, if the collar pin is small and discreet, and of the finest silver or gold. Stone's rule number 27. The cut of the suit matters. When LBJ became vice president, he promptly ordered 6 custom-made suits from Carr, Son, and War of Savile Row, London, who made suits for the Kennedys. In John Kennedy's case, he wore the suit, but in Johnson's case, the suit wore him. Kennedy made his clothes wearing look effortless and casual, while Johnson always looked like a gangly country boy in expensive duds. One need not spend a fortune to have a well-cut suit. If you can't afford custom, buy the highest quality garment you can, eschewing a garment that is fused. Now, take your suit to a fine custom tailor who does alterations, rather than the seamstress at the department store where you bought your suit. He can alter to your body. Always remember, it's the silhouette when seen from head to toe that matters. Remember the silhouette. The key thing to remember about a suit is the silhouette. Ideally, there should be an unbroken line from the skirt of the jacket to the cuff of the trouser. That's why trousers look better suspended from the shoulder rather than cinched at the waist. Stone's rule number 28. Never hold a meeting unless you know what result you want out of the meeting. In both politics and business, the amount of labor and time wasted in meetings is huge. It never ceases to shock me when I attend a meeting, only to find out halfway into it, that the organizers have no agenda and, by the end of it, have reached resolution on absolutely nothing. A strong leader meticulously plans and methodically orchestrates meetings in order to achieve a desired result, or he doesn't hold them. Stone's rule number 29. Be on time. Nick Rui, Richard Nixon's longtime traveling aide, advance man, and later ambassador to Iceland under Ronald Reagan, knew the 1968 Nixon campaign was meticulous about being on time for Nixon's public schedule. On the opposite end of the candidate punctuality spectrum would be the all-time worst presidential loser, Hillary Clinton, who would sometimes show up 2 hours late for scheduled appearances. Rui, the scion of a wealthy Grosse Pointe, Michigan family, said Nixon would be on time for all public events, except rallies, where he would be exactly 30 minutes late to give the warm-up man, often Johnny Grant, time to whip the crowds of Republican faithful into a frenzy. Whenever you met Rui for lunch at the 21 Club, you had to be exactly on time as scheduled. Rui would look at his watch with satisfaction, take a drag of his cigarette, and say, "Nixon men." Whether the appointment is big or small, be like Nixon, not Clinton. Always on time. Stone's rule number 30. Important meeting? Blue suit. The color blue connotes authority. A well-cut, dark blue suit is required for any public performance, where credibility and authority are key. When JFK showed up at the first 1960 presidential debate in a somber blue muted white-striped suit, and Vice President Richard Nixon showed up in a medium gray suit and a medium gray tie, it was already all over. John Kennedy's navy blue two-buttoned suit was to become the new American style. Nipped at the waist, and building the shoulders, it was in fact tailored in London. But the look was athletic and all-American. We know what happened. Your pants have to fit. Trousers should not fit tightly, nor should they be too loose at the seat. Baggy pants are reserved for clowns and vaudeville comedians. Yet a full-cut trouser which is suspended properly from the waist with braces, suspenders, should never look baggy. Stone's rule number 31. Mix and match. A gentleman can wear a navy blue suit with brown shoes. The Italians do it, and with a highly polished calfskin brogue, it has flair. Dressier black lace-ups such as cap toes or wingtips can wear as well. A navy suit is really too formal for slip-ons or loafers, which should be worn in tandem with sports jackets and the odd trouser. A tan suit and black shoes, on the other hand, should be avoided. The tan color in an appropriate weight cloth is essentially a summer suit, and black shoes would be too heavy for summer use. This is where the two-tone spectator shoe,